What can go wrong on a mission? Well, as a mission that works behind enemy lines, we've had a few things go wrong over the years. And when you put feet to your faith, you go into the field, you'll find all sorts of things go wrong, including your shoelaces breaking. Discomfort, disappointments, difficulties, and dangers are all part of our job description. One of our friends did this artwork, cartoon, early on in Frontline's history. What does a field trip involve? Months of preparation. Thousands of kilometers traveled. By the way, we're not the ones on the truck. We're in the motorbike behind in the dust. Punctures. Indeed. I had three motorbike punctures. When you've only got two tires, three punctures on one mission is a bit of a pain. But one of our teams had 18 punctures in one mission. 18 flat tires had to repair. And if I'm not mistaken, Hunter repaired something like that on his first Africa Overland to Sudan during his labola for marrying my daughter. Sleepless nights with friendly mosquitoes. No jokes. Many roadblocks. Scenic routes. A warm welcome from the locals. Interesting accommodation. Do you know, when I was captured and imprisoned in Zambia back in 1987, somebody pulled this out, one of the security branch people in Zambia. They had some of our newsletters and they pulled this out. And one of them was this, said, "What are you complaining about? Your own newsletter says there's interesting accommodation and mission." They were all laughing about this. So some of them have sense of humor as well. A close-up view of wildlife, as you had a chance to see some of today. Evangelistic opportunities. In fact, I remember this was inspired. You see the From Russia with Love's sticker at the back. This is inspired by my first Russian Bible distribution escapade in Maputo. There was in Maputo Central Harbor, and there's Russian warships there, and I was handing out Russian New Testaments, and I'd hand out quite a few, and I was feeling, you know, this is quite easy, this is going very well. And next thing, there's some big Boris who walked past me, bellowed something, came towards me, lifted me over his head and threw me in the harbor. That's, by the way, a long way from the pier down to the harbor. And then he threw the New Testament I'd just given him down on top of me, and a few others walked and threw them down too. So there I was trying to find a way out of the harbor and not feeling quite so successful after all. So Anne, who drew these, put this in for evangelistic opportunities. But the results make it all worthwhile. And then again, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. And this became a joke in the mission. Regularly, you'd be saying, well, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. And, of course, this is the cooking pot. So, somebody actually drew this, our first Great Commission camp that we ever had. One of the guests there just drew this on our whiteboard. So, interesting. And these are some of the souls who have traveled us. Letitia, one of the parabats, my brother helping me with a lift all the way to Joburg on the back of his bucky. It was nice to have the first 1,400 kilometers in a comfortable bucky before I had to go by motorbike into Mozambique. There was a time that Christian Motorbike Association loaned me an 1150 Suzuki, absolutely outstanding, loved this, could cruise at 240 kilometers an hour down the road. And this GSX 1200 was loaned to me by Christian Motorbike Association at one time. I was such a original member of Christian Motorbike Association, I've got just a two-digit membership number. Joined them right at the beginning. And, of course, in the field, motorbikes, do you know that the original name of Frontline Fellowship was Motorbike Mission? You can even check in Christian Handbook of Southern Africa, Frontline Fellowship, original name, Motorbike Mission. We start out as the Motorbike Mission. Along the line, we had to get buckies, and so regretfully had to change our name. And crossing rivers, how do you get across rivers with your motorbike? You get a boat. And obviously, some of the things that we have faced is lack of funds. I have slept out in the open, under trees, under bushes, maybe 4 years of my life. if I added all the nights I've slept under stars without any tent or anything like that. And the one time I remember sleeping out under the stars in Zimbabwe, and I woke up to a foul, foul, foul stench. And I had a torch in this hand, left hand, I switched it on, and I saw there was a hyena right over me about to do CPR on my face. In my other hand, I had a machete, panga, whacked him on the side of the head. Even middle of the night, woken up from a dead sleep, I was an animal lover enough to know not to hit him with the sharp side, I hit him with the flat side, because I didn't want to hurt the hyena, and heard this going, oing, 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 with the flat side of the, and he went, so I didn't hurt him, but I think I gave him a bit of a surprise. And after that, I learned you don't sleep out in the open, you sleep under a bush. You get low under a bush, put your sleeping bag so you can't get an animal like a hyena coming in. The other good thing to remember about having a hyena come and do CPR on your face late at night is remember to brush your teeth. If you don't brush your teeth, they're attracted by the smell of rotting meat between your teeth and so on. And I've seen people who've got their face missing because hyena bit the front part of their mouth off to get to their rotting teeth. Now, if that won't make you brush your teeth at night, nothing will. And this is literally how we camped out frequently. Ground sheet, I thought, I don't need a tent. Ground sheet's fine. And, yep, you want to be ready, boots on, ready for action in the field. That's the way we did missions in the 80s. What can go wrong on a mission? Lack of contacts in the field. The amount of times you get there and you feel like you're in the middle of a desert and there's no one around. Lack of information about the true situation of the ground, or misleading information, or false information, even worse. Division and dissension between team members. You would not believe the rubbish that can go on in the field sometimes. And you may wonder why you put under particular stresses, strains, and sleep deprivation, and some of the different challenges you get here. We are doing a selection and training course for people suitable for our mission, but we know it's beneficial for people who've got no commitment to our mission too, and we're happy for everyone to benefit. But you want to test people beforehand, because in the field, we've had some people do some incredibly treacherous, dangerous, and bad things. We've been betrayed in the field by foolish people, even people losing their temper, going berserk, literally going berserk. I had one person go berserk in prison when we were in Zambia in 87, and fortunately, the Zambian officials took him and put him in another prison entirely, because he was ruining our witness at this one place. He was on his first and last mission with us, but he did not respond well to what was happening. And we've had times where people have, well, we spoke to last Thursday night about the coping with conflicts and controversy in the field, and how all the great missionaries of the past had opposition. William Carey, David Livingston, it's Robert Morrison, Robert Moffat, Hudson Taylor. It's normal to expect attacks. And it's bad when it comes from your own side. You expect to be shot at by the enemy. You don't expect to be stabbed in the back by your own side. Desertion by team members. Believe it or not, we've been deserted in the field by key people. Lack of preparation by the field contact. On one particular occasion, I was going to the field, and we were sent a message by shortwave radio. We could actually send emails by shortwave radio all the way across. And now I'm talking about 20 years ago. It was advanced technology at that stage that you could send emails by shortwave radio. And they said, don't come. It's impossible. There's too much rain. The bridge is out and the river's flooded. And I communicate back. I was crossing the river before there was a bridge. This bridge was blown up by the Arabs a long time before. This is a bridge over the river, the Ye River, by Mundri, close to our mission base. On the one side is our mission base. On the other side is the airstrip. So when you land there, you've got to be able to cross this river to get to our mission base and all the rest. So the team said, no, the bridge is out. This bridge was blown away by the flood. In fact, it was a very, very serious flood. As I flew and I could see, the river was about seven times its normal size and width and everything else. So this was bad and serious. And when we got there, we could see, yes, the bridge indeed was washed away. But the team there was up to no good. And they were, in fact, there were complaints coming to us from the bishop and everything else. And so when we flew in, I could see as I flew in, deliberately flew over Mission Base, and I could see our vehicle was there. They didn't come to airstrip. They didn't come to river. They didn't come with all the different rigging that was needed for crossing the river with the wires, and they fled. So we had to actually cross this river, hand over hand, ankle over ankle. John, this ranger here with me, said, "Ranger, show the way," but he didn't have his gloves, and he went hand over hand, ankle over ankle in front. I came behind, passing his blood and meat, flesh all the way along. Why you want leather gloves? He fell into the river just shortly before the end. He couldn't take anymore, but he swam to the other side. You could see quite drenched. And I followed after. When we got to our base, our team had deserted. They'd fled with the vehicle we needed on the ground, and they'd fled. And there was all sorts of nonsense they were up to. Well, what can go wrong in a field? Punctures. We managed to acquire, a mission. We've got a chapter in Faith and Defiance, and what can go wrong on a mission? And everything went wrong on this particular mission. As we were traveling through the muddy roads, we got stuck horribly with this Land Cruiser, and we kept digging it out. And in this mud, unfortunately, one of our people, Hansi here, he got tetanus, and he was going into fever. So we had to start walking through to get help, because our vehicle was stuck. Our driver was in fever from tetanus, and we had nothing to treat him with. So John and I, not the John, you know, a lot older man than that, an American Ranger, we started walking with our AKs down the road. Now, we're going towards Ye, the capital of the resistance fighters at that stage, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. And we're walking down the middle of the road. Okay, it's a dirt road, but still, we're walking down the middle of this road in a war zone. And any moment, somebody could shout out something in Bari, Dinka, Zandi, who knows, languages we did not know. We're going into an area we did not know. And we didn't have a lot of the things we meant to have because of this team that fled. And we were walking down the road, and this is an operational area in the middle of a war, midnight. So you can imagine, but we couldn't just wait for daylight because our team member was in a bad way. We knew we had to get medical help to him quickly. So we're walking down the road, and would you believe, out of the mist comes an SPLA soldier walking with his rifles ready, and another one that way, sort of staggered as they should be, a patrol coming staggered like in Z formation down the road. So as I approached, I said, "Good evening." And the eyes went wide. "Good evening, good evening." Walk straight down the middle. They were passing by. John and I walk straight down. We've got our AKs. They've got their AKs. They're walking past this way. We were walking down the middle. There's an operational area. "Good evening, good evening, good evening, good evening." And kept going. And they disappeared in the mist behind. Their eyes were wide. They didn't say a word. They didn't stop us, didn't challenge us. I don't know what they saw, what they thought they saw, but bizarre. Now we're walking very carefully. And we know we've got to be close to Ye now. We've been walking for hours. It's about 3-4 in the morning. And I smelled smoke. So we're going even slower. And we see the chalk line across the road. We go slower. There's the barrier. There's a fire. There's people have been smoking, but they're all lying, sleeping. We're stepping over the guards, entering into the headquarters for the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, Ye, in the middle of the war. We passed the barrier, we kept going, and we found the mission base we wanted of the church, I should say, of the Episcopal Church that we were working with, and managed to find a medical person, so on, a borrowed motorbike, and the next morning we were heading back with aid and medical and so on, and then I'd already radioed and organized a flight to come in to casualty evacuate our team member who was suffering from fever and tetanus. And we had to get all of our Bibles and books, get everything there. And a plane that came in to fly him out. On the way, we flew us to where we need to be because our vehicle needed to be towed in. It couldn't be repaired at that stage. We were walking. We end up with bicycles that we donated to a different evangelist that we had to borrow that we could complete our mission. So we started with planes, vehicle, motorbike, bicycle, and walking. What can go wrong? Well, you could have visa problems. You can have your passport lost or stolen. I remember one mission that my son Calvin was coming on. He was only 8 at the time, and his passport had gotten lost and stolen. We only discovered the morning we were leaving. We had to quickly get a temporary passport. Can you imagine? You still got to drive Doorngon right up through Namibia. But anyway, that mission did take place, amazingly. What can go wrong on a mission? Delays. You can reach a border post and find the man with the key is not here. Well, why would a border post like this need a key? Well, somebody's got the stamp, and the stamp is locked in a drawer, and the man with the key is not here. And that happens. I've slept at border post multiple times through the night, waiting for the man with the key. He wasn't there that day, coming back the next day, and so on. What can go wrong? Impassable roads, rocky roads, muddy roads. Roads that just aren't there. Roads that are so, you know about the middle monkeys, where you're just careening across the road, and you sometimes the wheels are spinning and the car can't move because the middle monkey is so high that your car's just sitting and the wheels are spinning. And yes, this is typical conditions. We have spent on many a mission more hours digging our vehicle out than actually driving it. And the roads are beyond bad and shocking and seriously muddy. And the mud will come through the doors into your feet and clog everything. And if your backpacks aren't stored high enough, you can get there and all your clothes are muddy and everything is just muddy, muddy, muddy and rocky. Now, notice you've always got someone walking ahead. So often one person would walk ahead for river crossings. You might have 18 such river crossings in one mission. And with hiking stick, feeling where's the rocks, you don't suddenly want to rip the sump out from under your vehicle. You don't want to suddenly have your wheel drop into a depression and get locked there. So you've got to know where the dips are, and find the best way by walking through, feeling, and so on. And then you guide the vehicle through. So when a vehicle comes in, it cannot stall. If your vehicle stalls in the water, you cannot restart the engine underwater. It's going to blow the engine, gasket, all that sort of thing. Very bad. Of course, that's why you saw in the film last night what happens when the people aren't prepared and they don't have the winch prepared and haven't trained other people what to do, and the driver's getting out and the other person who's on his first mission is saying, tell me what to do, what must do. And the driver just wouldn't delegate, wouldn't do a thing. He gets out, stalls the engine because he's got to do it all instead of telling his passenger what to do. And then the vehicle was lost and it was underwater for 3 days. It took us days to dry out that vehicle. It was a real mess. Here you can see the broken, wrecked bridge. And then the footbridge we built, which was washed away in the flood. And now you can see during dry season coming down and crossing. And a whole lot of people getting a lift as well on top. Now, of course, you've got to make sure that all your vehicle equipment is well prepared, and you can see we've got these waterproof plastic trunks and duct tape, but you've got to recheck it after before every crossing, because the rocky roads is going to dislodge everything that you've packed, and you can be sure the seals will be broken, the duct tape will be broken, those waterproof tank containers won't be waterproof anymore. You're going to have to reseal everything before each crossing. And then you see something like this. This was a bridge in Zambia. Way, 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 way over in the eastern Zambia, almost in Angola, and it's over the tributary of the Zambezi. And would you believe our vehicle got across there? I would have walked it, I wouldn't have driven it. I wasn't on that particular one, I would not have taken our vehicle across. Shows what people do with a vehicle they didn't pay for. You get vehicle breakdowns. You get mechanical breakdowns. You get parts that are, this is the first driving with the most rugged four-wheel drive trailer in Africa, can survive everything, cracked on its first mission going up to Sudan. And needing to be fixed in the field. I mean, things like this, we took these pictures, showed it back to the people, and fortunately, the man back here had enough honor to fix everything, repair it. Of course, that's after we'd already have to travel 8,000 Ks back. But still, we had to fix it in the field, but he did change his whole design and did give us a whole lot of improvements so that we didn't have these problems in future missions. I don't think he realized how bad the bad roads in Africa are. This is part of our vehicle being fixed in Sudan. And yes, punctures. Did I mention punctures? Punctures can happen in the field. In fact, punctures will happen in the field. Inevitable. Tire blowouts at high speed. In fact, Elishka remembers this. Joseph remembers this. This is just one. We were racing with a big pressure between one conference and another meeting, and we were racing at rush hour to get from Pretoria through past Witbank, and tire gone at high speed. Could be a serious accident in traffic. Uncooperative, obnoxious board officials. I think you might have met some who were just acting the part, but I mean, let me tell you, there's some really obnoxious, uncooperative board officials. I think the way the customs services often work is, do you hate people? Do you have an obnoxious attitude? We have a job for you in the customs and immigration service. Just one example. This is another parabatch who's working with us. At this Mozambique embassy. Now, this is my first hostile border crossing. So I was in Swaziland. Let me tell you about my first experience going to Swaziland. So we have a meeting in Barberton at the Baptist Church, sleep the night there with the pastor's home and our sleeping bags. In the morning, we leave before the sun's come up, and we go up Pig's Peak, dirt road, get to top, into the Kingdom of Swaziland. As we cross, now this is my first experience crossing a border into an African country. So we cross over, and as we walk in, we hear thuds and thud, kick, whack, and so on. And see, just through the door, like door behind there, four policemen walk around kicking and beating some man on the ground. He's, I don't know what he's guilty of. Maybe he's a drug dealer. I have no idea. They never explained it. But they're hitting him with batons, they're kicking him, punching him, and so on. And four of them. So I'm standing there looking at this thinking, maybe this is a bad idea. I don't have peace about this. Maybe we should go back to South Africa and forget about coming to Swaziland. And then one of the policemen saw us, came over, asked what we're doing, passport this and this. And then, welcome to the Kingdom of Swaziland. And behind us, behind him, there's still kick, whack, thud. So, no explanation. But, I mean, my experience is the Swazi police were generally good people. This must have been a bad man. But anyway. Another time, I was traveling in Malawi on a train, and the train was so crowded and packed full, standing room only, that the guard at the back, what do you call it, the back guard box, anyway, caboose or whatever, he says, come on, over here. So he offered me his chair. There's only chair in this place with no windows. Because there's no windows, they had the sliding door open the whole time. So bolted into the ground and bolted into the wall was this metal chair. So I'm sitting on only decent chair. So, okay, I'm reading and weighing. One of the next railway stops, stations, along comes a policeman. He's got a criminal, I presume, handcuffed to him. He comes right in front of my chair, pulls out his trunks and out of his pocket, whacks this guy a few times over the head. He falls to the ground. He unlocks his handcuff. He handcuffs to the metal chair that I'm sitting on. It's bolted into the ground. No word of explanation. Don't know what the man is guilty of. Smiles, greets me, leaves. So we go on, and after a while, this man recovers, and he's sort of sitting up a bit groggy. And he's still handcuffed to the chair, and I'm reading. And next station, in walks another policeman. Pulls out his truncheon. After greeting me, whacks this guy over the head a few times. And undoes the handcuff, puts it on him, and drags this man out there. Again, no explanation. He probably deserved it. I mean, who knows? I have no idea. So we get to this embassy here in Swaziland. It's a Mozambican embassy. We did not have an embassy with Mozambique back in 1982 because we were at war with them and they were at war with us and all that. So, okay, so I go to this Mozambique embassy in a neutral country of Swaziland. And a man explains you need letters of authority and permission. You're not a Swazi citizen. You need some Swazi citizen to give a letter of endorsement. Now, fortunately, I'd been told before I left by the missionary I'd been mentored by, Francis Grimm, that there's a fine doctor, a Dr. Samuel Hind, in Swaziland. And if you can find him, he could be a help. So I went and found him. And do you know, Dr. Samuel Hind was the Minister of Health of Swaziland. He's a Nazarene missionary, American missionary, but he's the Minister of Health in Swaziland. Nice man. And his father, Dr. David Hind, was the personal physician to King Sobhuza. So he says, I could give you a letter, but you know, as a government official, it might be better if it came from my father, because I'm Minister of Health after all. So his father, David Hind, he writes beautiful letter on government letter, because he's the king's physician. Well, the name Dr. Hind is highly respected. I mean, the father's the physician to king, the son is the Minister of Health. So this letter, when I brought this in to the embassy, they were impressed. Things start to move. Come back in 2 weeks' time. Your passports must go to Maputo to be approved. I wasn't happy about that, but anyway. For 2 weeks, I kept busy going all around Swaziland, ministry meetings, all sorts of things. And then I finally came back to the embassy after 2 weeks to get my visa. And he said, oh, sorry, your visas have not arrived back yet from Maputo, nothing. And now I'm really frustrated because, you know, we've run out of, I've got no money left, nothing. I think there was 10 rand between myself and my coworker. I said, I need that passport. I've got to go back to South Africa. If I can't go to Maputo, we had nothing left. There's nothing. So he's looking at me for a moment. He pulls out the drawer. There are our two passports next to the stamp, next to the ink pad. Pulls out the ink pad, the stamps. These are the passports that are still waiting to get back from Maputo. They're sitting in this drawer the last 2 weeks, just for no reason. Anyway, we got our passports. Off we were to Mozambique. So it never had to go to Maputo anyway. Just border officials being a pain. You get meet bribe-hungry, corrupt officials. They're roadblocks, all kinds of roadblocks. Some of them are tanks. Theft by pickpockets and bag snatchers. Now, we could give you a lot of stories on this, but for example, one of our missionaries, he had taken my advice of getting a money belt to fit under his shirt, which has got all his documents in. But it was hot. So he pulled it out and he draped it across the, that's got his passport, ID, everything, money, and so on. And then across the, front of the car, you know, under the windshield. What do we call it? Just in front of the steering wheel. What do you have? The dashboard, exactly. And the windows are down because it's hot. Kara Road in Lusaka, a hand suddenly comes in, out goes all his documents and everything, and they pursued the person, never found him. One of our girls said all of her everything's in her handbag, and she's over her shoulder. Someone just came from behind, took it, and ran. Well, one of our people ran after, and fortunately, he is gaining because he's fit. All the morning PT helps. He is gaining on the thief who kept looking over his shoulder, and so he dropped the bag and kept running. Bag was retrieved with everything, nothing lost. But there's all kinds of nonsense that goes on. Money changers are cheaty on the exchange of currency. Now, I've had this happen to me twice. I can tell you both occasions were in Zambia. Sadly, both occasions were in the town of Livingston. But so the first time that they cheated me on this was, okay, they're talking about the exchange rate, and we work out the exchange rate, and he hands me the pile of money. I count my way through. I see it's the correct amount. I give it back to him instead of keeping it, which I should have done. Give it back to him, and then we count up mine, and then we exchange. Later on, I found he had, in the moment that we were counting mine, switched it for one that had the big denominations on the outside and worthless denominations on the inside, so I'd been cheated a lot of money. The second time, we are counting, and I'm very careful now. I'm going to take the amount and count it out and then keep it and so on. But as we start to count out my money, someone comes from behind, grabs that money and runs. Now, I'm pursuing him. But then everyone with me is running as well. And then next thing, they're interchanging, and then they're all bombshell. I don't know which one's got the money. They're all working together. The whole group was there distracting me and so on and so forth. You cannot negotiate with a group of people around. You've got to do one-on-one person. You've got to count out the money, keep that, then it counts out yours, give, and you can't be distracted. Once it was done by our car, door open, so on and so forth, and while doing it, a cell phone was stolen from outside the door panel. The mobs around there are pickpockets and thieves just waiting. They attracted tourists, foreigners, people traveling. They don't care if you're a missionary. There's no fear of God. These folks will steal you blind. Everything. You've got to lock everything, watch everything, keep everything under lock and key, and have it on you. I take my passport and everything with me into the shower. I would not leave. You can't leave things behind. You cannot. It'll be stolen. It's like you've got to be aware that there are not tens of thousands. There's millions of thieves all over the mission field just waiting to steal from anybody passing by. Your passport, everything. The amount of people we've had arriving at a GCC or leaving a GCC or coming to a conference on who were robbed by thieves at Johannesburg Station or Messina. And, oh, it's shocking. The absolute callous wickedness of these folks who will steal from anybody they possibly can. And these poor folks coming from up country who, you know, from a country like Malawi, where they're pretty basically honest, and they come to South Africa and they find all these thieves who will just steal everything. I'm afraid Zambia and Zimbabwe have got lots of those too. Misleading directions. Not far. Keep going straight or this. And they know they haven't a clue, but to make you feel better, they will give you directions like they actually know what you're talking about and where you want to go. And I don't know if sometimes it's malicious or if it's just the person wanted to look good in your eyes by giving you confident directions, but misleading directions that'll waste hours, days. And really offend you. Yep, that is normal. Getting lost. Getting lost is part of missions. That's why, by the way, I believe in maps. I believe in compasses. GPS is fine. I mean, that's not my generation's technology. But don't depend on any one thing at all, because sometimes the maps are out of date. Sometimes we've had it before in Mozambique. You get to this bridge, and the bridge is gone. According to the map, the latest AA map, there's a bridge there, but it's got a hole at exactly a key place. You can't get a vehicle over it. A person could walk across this bridge, but you can't get a vehicle over it. And, I mean, it's like a plank over a broken section of the bridge, and you can't get a vehicle across there. You had to go 200 kilometers around to get around this bridge. Well, we'd expected to get there. Now, according to GPS, this bridge existed. According to the map, the bridge existed. You get there, and the bridge does not exist. This is the Zambezi River. You can't just improvise. It's a long way around, and this happens frequently. The best directions, the best maps, the best GPS can still be wrong. You want directions. You want information. When I'm going anywhere, it's nice to have someone who's been there before. It's nice to get up-to-date information. Someone has just come from there. You continually have to ask questions. Doesn't matter how good your technology is and how good your information is and how good your maps are. It'll let you down time and again because people haven't bothered to update it with what actually is going on. Frequently, we've crossed rivers by dugout canoe. And by the way, these are patrolled by flat dogs, crocodiles. And you don't want to get it wrong. And of course, there are fires. Many fires. Arson, yes. You get arson fires, Muslims, terrorists, all over the place. Yes, car bombs, all sorts of things. Aerial bombardments, which cause fires in the dry season, like in Sudan. Floods. Yes, we get floods. And there are times when you can have your bridge washed away and you've got to cross a flooded river. So floods are a reality. And not just in the field. You can have floods. The worst flood we ever had was in Mpumalanga, Eastern Transvaal, trying to get in and out of Back to the Bible mission of General Mulder. This is near Durban. You can have bad floods in Natal. This can happen. You don't even have to go to the field for this. Storms? Sickness? Okay, what kind of sicknesses have we had? Obviously, dysentery, malaria, that's obvious. Hepatitis, sure. And then there's a whole lot of other things that you can get from the choleras, tetanus, you name it. In fact, I have no idea what disease I've had in some cases. I remember coming back from the field so sick, they CAT scanned me, did everything you could do. And at the end, they wrote virus, in brackets, tropical. My mother, who's a nurse, said that means they don't have a clue. Tropical virus means I don't know what it could possibly be. And so when I went to be tested for, they sucked 26 vials of blood out of me for being tested at Frederiksberg to be prepared to donate my kidney to our son, Christopher. And they turned me down for different reasons. One was cholesterol was just a bit too high, blood, the blood pressure was just slightly elevated. But they had a sheet, I'm kidding you not, like 4 or 5 pages long of just sicknesses and disease I've had, which I could get from my blood. And, you know, of course, there's the malaria, and of course, there's the dysenteries and things like this, and all that. But there was a whole lot of things where I looked at, and I couldn't even spell it or pronounce it. I mean, who knows what they were. All kinds of weird diseases that Frederiksberg transplant units read in my blood. Now, how about that? A person can get a few drops of your blood, and they can tell every disease you've ever had. How's that? Scorpion bites. We have had a lot of different scorpion bites. Now, quick way of understanding. You get the big scorpions with these big clippers and a thin tail. Nothing. It's like a bee sting. It's like, ow. Then you get these thin tail, thick pinchers, also pinprick, barely itches. But this yellowish, light-colored creep with the little clippers, pinchers, but the thick tail. This is the deadly venomous. They can kill you. Well, I was bitten by one of those. And we would kill 6, 8, 12 scorpions around our sleeping bags in the Nuba Mountains on a single night before going to bed. I mean, you're just going around there and you're looking. But we actually had a kind of light that was ultraviolet that you could, these guys glow in there to spot the scorpions. And we'd be killing them all around our sleeping bags and other sleeping bags. And by the way, when you get up in the morning, before you put your boots on, you shake your boots out, things like that, because you don't want to get a scorpion. There might be a new boot, and that would be very painful if you put your foot in. Well, what happened with us? Well, I was showering, when you're saying shower, Sudanese shower, you behind these reeds or something, and you're bouncing on some sticks or rock, and you've got a bit of a bucket of water, and you've got your little mug, and so you a little bit of water, soap, a little bit more, rinse, and so on and so forth. So in doing this, you know, so my eyes, I put my hand for my towel and felt this bite in my hand. And it's from these blasted little yellow, thick-tailed, thin pinchers, scorpions. And I could feel phenomenal pain in my hand. It bit me in my left hand, and I could feel a venom moving up my arm. And quickly wrapped towel around me, went outside. And I mean, we hours flying time to the nearest hospital in Kenya. This is the Nuba Mountains behind enemy lines. No medical anything there at that time. And so all I could do was James 5, call elders to pray for you. There was nothing else. And, you know, as far as I could see, I was going to be dead in a short. I could feel this pain moving up my arm, just past the elbow, just heading right towards my heart. And they prayed for me, and I knew, you know, when John says we know that God heals, well, as they prayed, it was the most remarkable thing. I felt this poison leave my shoulder, go past my elbow, head towards my hand, go out through the fingertips. It was like extraordinary, so fast. Now, this was, there were several other people, and by the way, it included include Pat Matriciana, the filmmaker of who did that terrorism and persecution film. Extraordinary. So there we were, and they prayed for me, and I could feel the poison heading towards me, knowing that in a few moments I'll be dead. And then I felt this poison just moving out. So there's no doubt, there's no way you can survive these sort of things without God. The venom? Well, I don't know. This was too fast. This was so fast. I can imagine if you've got a localized pain, there's poison there, maybe make an incision X, squeeze out the poison, suck out, don't swallow, spit out, and so on, rinse your mouth well. They say, in fact, I carried for many years a suction cup for this very reason, because I thought, I'm not going to put my mouth over some snake bite wound and suck out poison. What if I accidentally gulp it? So I had the suction thing, which we carried around for a while. Yes, theoretically, if you could squeeze out the poison, tourniquet, but, you could lose the limb. But even then, I don't know if that would have, I don't think a tourniquet would have stopped this. This was a lot of serious poison. Anyway, we've had scorpions. We have all sorts of strange things going on in the field. There was a time Calvin was on this mission, 2008, we're up in Caprivi, and he felt something squishy, reached down to pick it up, and when I put torch on, I thought, gee, this is a long guy. In fact, there's a lot of them there. By the time I pulled out my camera, this is how much was there. Because Calvin was reaching out to pick it up, and I said, you're not Steve Irwin. This is dangerous. And when the people whose campsite you're staying at heard about this, this is very close to the Mbezi River. So you get snakes. And when you hear a knock on the door, you shouldn't always open it. Just you don't know what could be there. Injuries happen. Do we get injured? Yes, we do. Vehicle accidents. I'm glad this wasn't one of our vehicles. But did we mention you can get big potholes in Africa? And river crossings are pretty bad if you don't have someone walk ahead to check what's under the water, because it may look even, but it's not. Communication breakdowns between missionaries and hosts. And by the way, don't expect bridges that are out to have a sign ahead saying bridge out. No mobile, no internet connection. That happens frequently. And malaria. We get malaria. And we get all kinds of strange things. And you can imagine when you're in the field, there's no end of problems that can come out. Bad news or distractions from home. One of the disadvantages of missions today is the good communications. Because in the old days, missionaries could be in the field and they could get on with their work for years. And they'd get the bad news when I got back home. But now, you can get the bad news on the hour, every day. And we've had missionaries whose parents endlessly faked bad news. Your mother's dying, if she wasn't, to try and get the person to leave the field and come back home and all sorts of things. So the bad news and distraction at home, the people who don't support the children being in the field, and they plain lie to discourage the kids to get them back from the field so they can keep them from going back to the field. So that happens. Of course, loss of prayer support, loss of financial support, loss of emotional support. I was a new missionary, engaged in the field, and I got a letter. Dear Peter, it's been nice knowing you. We'll always be friends, that sort of thing, from my fiance. I'd been in the field for nearly 4 months, but still, it was, things like that can so disorientate you. You become unclear and willing to take ridiculous risks. Loss of vehicle keys. One of the dumbest ever in the history of a mission has got to be, we had a vehicle and we had one key. And I said to the co-worker, who's the main driver, make sure you get a copy of that key before we go in the field. Well, he didn't. We went into Zimbabwe and we started vehicle problems, and he gets out and he's fiddling with this key, acting like it's a tool under the hood, in the engine. I said, should you be doing that? And this chap's a trained mechanic, qualified mechanic. He says, now these keys are really tough. Snap. Our ignition key brakes, and this engine's been hot. We've been driving like 8 hours. And the key's now in the middle, you can't reach it. Now, it's a Saturday. We're outside Fort Victoria, what do they call it now? Masavingo. And so after a while, we managed to get this out and walk into town to find a locksmith. Locksmith's closed Saturday afternoon. Have to go to the police. They've take us to the locksmith. Locksmith, walk out of town. We talk about hours and hours and hours waste, which if we just had a spare key or didn't use the main ignition key as a tool, we would have saved ourselves a lot. But it's stupid things like that you learn afterwards. Whatever you do, have spare keys. And by the way, make sure someone other than the driver has got the second set of keys. You don't want to lock both sets of keys in the car. So things, and things like that happen. Rodents eating equipment. We've had rodents eating not just equipment. We've had them eating our food supplies. If you leave your zip of your bag just a little bit open, they will get in there. And they will get through your Ziploc bags. They'll get through your double Ziploc bags. They will eat your main food supply. They will eat their way, and if that's close to other equipment, they'll eat their way through the equipment too. And so we've got leads, video projectors, you name it, chewed up by rodents. I came back with bags where you've got the rodents' teeth marks all the way through. And yes, well, I mean, there's times that I've come to my home and my wife says, don't even think about coming in the house. You stand right there, hose me down, you know, clothes off there in the garden. This is all going straight into the bin. Literally everything I came back from and Sudan with once was just thrown away. And the bags, the rodent teeth there, like bag just into the bin, hose you down, Dettol bath. I've had rats running over my pillow, running over my sleeping bag, running over me. I've had them running over my face, over my sleeping bag. Because they often put us in the best hut in the village, which will, of course, have the grain stock, which will, of course, have the rats. And they say if you see one rat, there's 10. If you see two rats, there's 100. I mean, the rats are there by huge numbers. One hut I stayed in Sudan, they, after all these problems that I mentioned about the rats, they surrounded, the whole village surrounded the hut and started to break through. And they killed 150-something rats in that one hut I was staying in. We would be sleeping with a machete in one hand, maglite in the other, batting away rats all night. That literally happened. They ate their way through everything. Hunger and dehydration happens frequently. I've had sunstroke. I've had heat exhaustion. I've been delirious in the field. So you don't even know what's right, wrong, what's the distance. You could be here and this feels like a warehouse and the back is like kilometers away and just totally disorientated. If you haven't had sunstroke, you can praise God, but you do not want to get dehydrated in the field. Ambushes. Ambushes happen. I've been shot at while traveling in Mozambique. Ambush Alley, they call this. And of course, we've been attacked on many different occasions. Here's a vehicle passed. It's a Kenyan vehicle passing by in Sudan. You can see the bullet holes and everything shot out. And this car, the people in this car did not survive. South Africa, they've actually got signs like this, hijacking hotspots. You thought, well, if it's so, and they know about it, they could put a sign there. Couldn't they do something to prevent it? And, of course, all sorts of things happen during Bible smuggling into Sudan and the UN banning our flights and threatening to shoot us down. We've done a lot of flights in Sudan. Well, all of our flights in Sudan were actually illegal. Shoot on site, no fly zones, you fly, you die, that sort of thing. To get these Bibles in, we had to bypass jets, helicopter gunships. Now, this plane is the same plane that I did my first flight into the Nuba Mountains with. But fortunately, we were not flying this when it crashed. It ran out of airstrip before it ran out of airspeed, and this beautiful British Lockheed crashed, and it's still there. I don't know what's still there, but they couldn't get it out. They couldn't recover it. Whatever is left is still on the runway. Aerial bombardments. We've been bombed by air in Sudan. We've been bombed by air in Angola. And whether with UNITA freedom fighters, fighting in the war in Angola, we've experienced being strafed, rocketed, bombed, including by supersonic jet fighters in Sudan. Here's the Bishop's House being bombed. Here's another bomb crater at our school. This is one unexploded bombs at our school. There's all kinds of wreckage of bombings. So this is normal. The Arabs would bomb schools, churches, mission stations, markets, you name it. I don't think I've, in the 1,200 meetings I've had in Sudan, I don't think I've ever spoken to a church or school that hasn't been bombed at least once. Some have been bombed 18 times. And here's a helicopter gunship picture being taken while being strafed, our team being shot up in the Nuba Mountains. And these are some of the people wounded in the attack. being in churches under attack, I've been rocketed and bombed while we were having churches. We all had to dash outside, dive for cover. Some of that's covered in 3 days in Sudan. And even when we were running an evangelism explosion training course, we were bombed on Sunday morning while we're presenting the first Bibles in the Moro language. So these things happen. 8 1,000 kilogram bombs all in the space of 100 meters, and yet we didn't lose a person. And it just reminds us that the Bible is a message of life and death. So the trees could be filled with shrapnel, but the people were not, because of God's grace and mercy. The Bibles of the Christians are more powerful than the bombs of the Muslims. We've come under artillery bombardments, not just in the army, but in missions. The church where my brother and my father were was converted, St. James, where quite a few of our mission staff and members worshipped, was attacked by terrorists. St. James, 1993, 25th of July. And good friends that we knew in this beautiful sanctuary attacked by terrorists. Mines happen, minefields. There are millions of mines still on the go in Africa. And we've often got to go in soft skin vehicles in areas where landmines are the national plant. They've put death threats over us. Of course, what can happen? Torture. James Cromer took his picture in Sudan when he was 52 years old. His arm was cut off by the Arabs. This UNITA freedom fighter in Angola had his arm cut off. This evangelist in Sudan had both his feet axed off by the Arabs. It didn't stop him evangelizing them. You can have missionaries die in the field. I mentioned to you last night about Anthony Duncan, who died in December 1994. Series of missions. You can be captured. I've been captured 3 times and imprisoned, and that includes Mozambique, Angola, Mozambique, Zambia, and Sudan. And we've hit the news headlines on a number of occasions for that. Yes, arrests happen. Imprisonments happen. I had a reason to be grateful to the Iron Lady of Britain. In October 1987, I and 3 of the frontline missionaries were prisoners in Zambia, and Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher personally spoke up for us and secured our release. Zambia, the warm heart of Africa, they called sometimes. Well, it wasn't that warm heart of Africa back in 1987. It was a communist dictatorship under Kenneth Kaunda. And this is the prison where we were locked in. This is a military intelligence aerial photo. That's the entrance to the prison. You can see, well, I'll show you a picture of it in a moment. That's the entrance to prison. Here's some of the interrogation blocks. Here's the main machine gun tower. The little door that entered into, the only entrance is just under here. This is the cooking shed. That's a death row. I was in cell 11 about there, which was presidential detainee section. This prison was built by the British for 80 prisoners. There were 1,200 in there when I was there. When Kenneth Kaunda was locked up in this prison, he had bed with sheets and pillows, and he had a couch, and he had a desk, and he had books and access to the library, and he had electricity and plumbing and all the rest of it. And when we were there, there were 65 prisoners per cell. Where Kenneth Kaunda was given a cell on his own, he would shove 60 odd. Now, he's a humanist. He didn't believe in the depravity of man taught by his parents, who were Calvinists. He believed in the goodness of man. He's a humanist. That's why he could lock people up there without trial. The British brought him 3 cooked meals a day. He gave his people who were locked up there 1 meal a day, and it was starch only. The only protein came from the flies, big cooking pots, big enough for a missionary family, and just starch. And they would, they wouldn't even get bowls, wouldn't have eating utensils. Literally had to have the food dished up in your hands and eat like that. There was no eating utensils, no plates, no electricity, no plumbing. No sanitation whatsoever. Disease factory, stinking disease factory. Couldn't take the picture at the time, but later when went back as a missionary, speaking there after we kicked out the commies, was able to get a picture of what it was like there, basically. Those are the kind of cells. It didn't look this nice when I was brought in there through the little door, but this is after Lusaka Central was repainted. The frontline mission team I was leading had been arrested at Kazangulu Ferry, the one place in the world where 4 countries meet. Southwest Africa, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, all met at Kazangulu Ferry. across the Zambezi River, and we went, my cousin Gulu Ferry, from Botswana into Zambia. And when I refused to bribe Zambian officials, we were arrested. We spent excruciating weeks of abuse at the hands of the Zambian security forces and filthy cells. This is again after the communists were overthrown. We were able to get a picture of what our sleeping conditions were like in the cells. That's what it was like in the cells. 15 feet by 25 feet. Not bigger than this room here that we're in. And 65 people crammed in there. No bedding, no equipment, no sanitation, just filthy, disgusting disease factories. We were blindfolded, handcuffed, interrogated, incarcerated in the overcrowded Lusaka Central Prison. But friends of ours had ensured that the British Prime Minister was informed of our plight just before departure for the Commonwealth Conference in Vancouver. 1987, October, all these countries are gathering at Vancouver, and the primary target was Margaret Thatcher. There, Margaret Thatcher was subjected to haranguing by Zambian dictator Kenneth Kaunda, who was outraged because Britain was refusing to place economic sanctions on South Africa. So Margaret Thatcher responded by asking, why does Zambia not herself place sanctions on South Africa? Kenneth Kaunda responded, that would place many Zambians out of work. Exactly, responded Margaret Thatcher. And as South Africa is one of our most important trading partners, many British citizens would be placed out of work if I was to impose sanctions on South Africa. Quite aside from many South Africans themselves, they'd be placed out of work. She went on to relate how Zambians were dependent on South African maize, mealie-meal, grown in Orange Free State, how Zambian Airways was maintained by the South African Airways, how Zambian Railways was maintained by South African Railways. In fact, we provide the locomotives that pulled their trains. South African veterinarians cared for Zambia's cattle. If they got bitten by a snake, the snake bite serum came from Pretoria. Many Zambians, hundreds of thousands of migrant workers in South Africa. She related how many hundreds of millions of pounds are put into the Zambian treasury every year in foreign exchange. Kenneth Kaunda then declared that because of South Africa's human rights abuses, Britain should impose sanctions on South Africa. It was at this point that Margaret Thatcher produced our information. Who are you to speak about human rights abuses? You are the unelected dictator of a one-party state. Four British missionaries are being held without trial as presidential detainees in Lusaka Central Prison, tortured and abused by your own security forces. Kaunda was dumbstruck, humiliated, and he ordered our immediate release. When he came off the airstrip, apparently the first thing he said in Lusaka Airport was, get those missionaries out of here. And we were taken on the way. I noticed this wasn't taken then, this was taken a few years later, but I couldn't help but notice that the freedom statue was behind bars. It seemed awfully symbolic. Well, in the prison, in the Lusaka Central Prison, we met, amongst others, General Godfrey Meander, who had also been locked up there because he had said in private conversation that sanctions would hurt Zambia more than South Africa. And for that unpatriotic comment, he was locked up in the prison, along with a major who was a Sandhurst graduate engineer. And Frederick Chalubu became the next president of Zambia, and so on. Not that I remember meeting him, but apparently he's locked up in the same prison at the same time. But Godfrey Meander became a good friend. He became vice president. He became minister of education and a whole lot of other things. 1991, Zambia was able to kick out the communist dictator, Kenneth Kaunda, and they had a multi-party democracy. And they dedicated themselves to Christ, and Zambia became officially a Christian country. They banned abortion, banned pornography. And I took a whole pile of books, many of the books you see here, to Minister of Education, Godfrey Meander. And Godfrey Meander groaned and he said, I love reading, but the demands of office give me very little time to read. Don't you have a small book that summarizes all of these? And so I produced Biblical Principles for Africa, which has gone through so many reprints and so many expansions and updates and revisions, and translated into Afrikaans and translated into French and taken to the Congo. And we were invited by Godfrey Meander and others to minister at their schools, their teacher training colleges, to run biblical worldview seminars in Lusaka. In fact, I was running this biblical worldview seminar in 1994 in Zambia when we heard of our team being arrested, coming back from Bible smuggling and medicine delivering to Angola. One of the people we met while in prison in Lusaka was this Baptist evangelist, Bishop Wanali Fili, good friend of ours, board member of Frontline as well, he came to the prison and he saw us barefoot, dirty, bedraggled, bearded, unshaven, unwashed, in those terrible conditions. And he was horrified. And he's the one who blew the whistle and newspapers were broadcasting four missionaries locked up in Zambia, Lusaka Central Prison and all this, and helped to get whole things mobilized on our behalf within Zambia too. Well, we've been invited many times to Zambia and helped with all sorts of book productions. Here's my father-in-law, Bill Batham, speak on radio in Zambia. Calvin and I up in Zambia ministering at Bible colleges, church conferences, church planting projects. The people there were impressed to see how Calvin, as a youngster, could give the Ten Commandments, pray the Lord's Prayer, explain evangelism, explosion, deal with a whole lot of Bible memory verses. This is where we used to swim across the crocodile-infested river, smuggling into Angola. So when Calvin was just 8, took him up to Zambia because I knew the people, especially the men, did not believe in giving much time to their children. They thought, you know, that's not a man's problem. So to show them that you can invest in your sons and just through repetition teach them Bible memory verses. And so even at this pastor's conference and others, Calvin got a lot of people really impressed and got him to meet another good friend of ours. This is General Ronnie Shikapashwa. General Ronnie Shikapashwa was head of the Zambian Air Force. He was crippled in a car accident and told you'll never walk again. His wife got converted. He got converted. He got healed. He became Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Home Affairs, and a Minister of Information at different times. So over the years, he was one of our hosts. And I remember one time I was in a situation. We were staying at a campsite, and a bunch of drunkards came to the swimming pool and started to really perform. And Calvin was swimming there in the pool, and I was getting disturbed. It's a sign even saying, you know, no alcohol allowed, and only this is only for people who are swimming in this area. And here they were having a drunken party or something in the swimming pool. So I went and I challenged him about it politely. Immediately it was, you know, you whites think you've got the, you're a racist. Would you say this if it was white people? I said, more so. Yes, indeed. And they, you know, Mugabe's right, should kill all you whites. And is this, that, and the other. And so at one point I said, I'm the guest of General Ronnie Shikapashwa. And did this man, oh, the one person say, I'm a policeman. I could have you arrested. You could disappear. I could have you killed. Nobody would know anything about it. And when I said I'm a guest of General Ronnie Shikapashwa, they sobered up so quick. Because General Ronnie Shikapashwa at that stage was Minister of Internal Affairs, which put him in charge of the police force as well. He was their direct superior. Did they sober up and start trying to sweet talk me and be very nice? Just extraordinary. You see, in Africa, it's not what you know. It's who you know. You know the right people, it makes all the difference. Well, General Ronnie Shikapashwa got us even to meet the president, Levi Mwanawasa, and we had a good hour of discussion, prayer with him. And Levi Mwanawasa had been a Jehovah's Witness. He is excommunicated for getting involved in politics. Jehovah's Witnesses are not meant to get involved in politics. So he then was in high office, was the president, but he had no more church. And as we shared the gospel with him, shortly after that, he went and he joined the Lusaka Baptist Church, got baptized as a believer, and he spent the rest of his years as a faithful member of the local Baptist Church. Expect wildlife on the road. And remember, first rule of the road, elephants have right of way. And elephants have right of everything, actually. And never cross a solid yellow line in the middle of the road. This is a solid yellow line in the middle of the road.
What happens when you do it?
Sorry?
What happens when you do it?
You do not even want to think about that. The lines have right of way as well. And yeah, another solid yellow line of in the road. You don't cross a solid yellow line. And when there's a lot of solid yellow lines, you don't even think about it. And if you don't pay attention, remember it's their territory. Expect bad roads, expect delays, expect serious delays, expect challenges, expect opposition, expect persecution. Yet in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. In fact, I've written a book, Security and Survival Handbook, specifically with missionaries in mind, how to survive everything on foot, on the road, in place, during bombings, during capture, during imprisonments, because it's happened to us. So this Security and Survival Handbook is one of our practicals we'll be sure you have. So let me stop at that point. Any questions, any comments, complaints, or criticisms? Aliska.
When you were in jail with many people, were you sharing the gospel with them?
Oh, yes, in fact. So, it was quite an experience. The first thing was that you've got to understand there's a good cop, bad cop, good cop, bad cop routine. And so there'd be the one person who's all sweet talking to you, very nice, smearing honey around your mouth, to use the Afrikaans term. And there's the other one who's just wanting, you know, electrocute, kill, whip, and all that. And so they hope that after a while you're going to Stockholm Syndrome, identify with the good cop for protection because he's being reasonable. And in this way, they want to break you. And they, of course, raise expectations. Everything's been sorted out. You'll be released soon, and so on and so forth. And then next thing, now we know you're all spies. And so it went backwards and forwards. And so there was up and down and up and down. But I knew how these things worked. Thankfully, because I'd read the book When Hell Was in Session by Captain Jeremiah Denton just before that particular mission. So I understood the way communists work and how you survive in prison. So one thing was to keep your mind active. And when we were blindfolded, which was for hours and hours and hours, memorizing, trying to keep track of time, type of road, gravel road, dirt road, solid road, tarmac, you know, different types of vehicles, back of a Bedford truck, plainly, can hear from the sound. And trying to keep understanding and memorizing things and the voices and type of people, how many people, where they are around you, and noticing what type of locks, what type of fixtures, everything. So I kept my mind active, and it's so important to keep your mind active. Because if you don't keep your mind active, they can break you easier. And also physical exercise, using every opportunity. And one solitary confined cell I was in, I could touch the one part of the wall with my head at the same time as my toes are touching the other side, my hands could touch the other two walls. That's how small the cell was. And there's a gap beneath the door which rats came in and out. And wake up, rats sort of by your nose, lying on the side there on the concrete floor. Of course, no bedding and so on. Now, it was important to keep physically and mentally active. So when we got to this Lusaka Central Prison, the sun was setting, it was getting dark, the people already in the cells, they opened the cell door, the presidential detainee section. And we had a businessman from Mali, we had a Hindu mine owner who'd been thrown, we had people from all over the world. So that was a very interesting cell. And as we were going into the cell, the prison guard said, "These are terrorists responsible for the deaths of millions." Quite simple. Terrorists responsible for the deaths of millions. As they pushed us in, slammed it all behind. I mean, basically, they said, tear these guys apart. You know, they wouldn't care if they came back the next morning and found we were dead. That was basically. So as we got in the cell, the first thing I could do is I greeted them in the name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, started to share the gospel with them, explained we were missionaries. And immediately, there were other Christians in the cell who then became allies. And so every day I preached the gospel. Every day I counseled people solidly all day. We'd walk up and down. People want to talk to me, walk with me. Walk backwards and forwards across the courtyard and counsel, getting physically fit, walking. So I'd walk many kilometers a day, just backwards and forwards in the cell. And then we'd preach and we had whole service. So six times while I was preaching, the prison guards would come and take me while I was preaching, drag me out. Off to interrogation, and you know, sometimes could be gone for 6 hours interrogation. And I mean, that was all the kind of waterboarding, all that sort of stuff. And it was only by preaching that everyone at prison respected us. And I think, and in fact, they were on our side. There was no hostility towards us from the prisoners when they realized where we stood. Because many of them there, they were Christians and they knew this government's evil. But at first, if we'd kept quiet, we probably wouldn't have been alive by morning. If we didn't preach, I think we would have been dead. Yes. Lusaka Central Prison was 16 days. Although, of course, at the time we didn't know, we thought we could be there for years. You know, most of the prisoners there had never been to trial. They hadn't had the day in court. Of the 1,200 prisoners, most were remand prisoners. Now, a remand prisoner doesn't have a uniform, a prison uniform yet. He's still wearing a civilian clothes, which are in tatters. One man we spoke to had been there for 8 years and he'd never had a day in court. He'd never been sentenced. He's still waiting for his trial. We asked what the problem is, that they'd lost the witness. And he's still in prison 8 years later. So that's the kind of things we found there. So later on, after I was released, I was contacted by the lawyer for Kenneth Gordon, the dictator, for me to come back to Zambia so he could apologize for bad treatment. So I said, now I know how this works. The president is in trouble and he needs to have positive public image. So he's bringing me in to help him with his public image. Well, I want something in return too. I want to be able to return to the prison where I was locked up in, but I can't return empty-handed. I've got to be allowed to bring in soap, salt, paper, books, Bibles, things, medicines, vitamins, all sorts. So I gave a whole list of things I want to bring. You've got to allow me that. Without that, I won't come. And so there was actually a few years backwards and forwards until he finally is desperate. 1991, come. And I was allowed to have an evangelistic crusade. I was allowed to go into the prison and I took in the things, but I had to appear on national TV. So I did that. But on national TV, they made a big mistake. It was live. It wasn't recorded. So the host says, oh, I'm sure that you're happy to be back in Zambia in such different circumstances from before because of the misunderstanding. Because I was a VIP. I came in, didn't have to clear customs, flown in, and red carpet kind of treatment. So I said, yes. When I came in October 87, I was arrested for refusing to pay a bribe, and I just kept talking smoothly. Thrown to this prison, a 1,000-ton prison, most of which were remand, which had never had their day in court, and no running water. And you could just see her eyes widen. She was getting quite panicked, but I just spoke smoothly, just a minute. No hesitation, no repetition, no deviation. And I sort of unloaded all the ghastly horrors of Lesotho Central Prison, what the government was doing. And she is in a state of shock, and I could just see. I thought afterwards, I felt sorry because she'd probably lose her job. But over national TV, we communicate some of the things that they'd never want the people to know what's going on in their prisons. And shortly after that, there was such an overwhelming backlash that of the first three elections ever, and Kaunda was kicked out. Five votes against him for every one for. So absolute landslide. Kicked out Kaunda. I was told that by our friends who had been in prison with us that my stand on the only TV station at all, I mean, it's the only one channel, prime time, that what I said on there was another nail in the coffin of Kaunda. It helped bolster many people's courage to rise up and kick out this disgusting dictator. Many got released because many were political prisoners. In fact, the whole new government were people who had been in Lesotho Central Prison. Quite a few of them had been in our cell. So I was now buddies with the new government of Zambia. So I'd get in with VIP, not having to pay visa fees, not having to. So, you know, the people are lined up at the airport to go in. And then they'd take me off the plane, whisk straight past into a VIP lounge and someone would bring your cases and off there without having to go through customs because you're VIP. Only country in the world I've ever been treated like that. So I went from being presidential detainee to VIP.
Was it related to being the
overcrowded cell was better because we had ministry. Now, we didn't have Bibles. All we had to do was Bible memory. So it was better. In fact, I made some very good friends. And every night was solid, solid. In fact, it was 16 days of intensive ministry. So whereas in Mozambique, I was in solitary confinement most of the time and all of that. But in Lusaka, most of the time was ministry. Some of the time was interrogation. And I had one night of solitary confinement before we were dragged off to Lusaka Central. So, no, definitely... Solitary confinement is bad. Yes.
What do you find is the best vehicle for doing missions?
Vehicle. Well, we've used Toyota four-wheel drives like the one you see there. Obviously, we believe in that as a good one because there's a lot of spares all over the place as well. Toyota's four-wheel drives are very popular in Africa. Personally, if they were available, I'd like to have the Volkswagen four-wheel drives because I like that engineering. But in Africa at the moment, Toyota is the most common, and therefore it's easiest for us to get a spare part when we need it. In fact, we had a whole fleet of Toyotas at one stage. And that's another interesting story, because when pornography started to be legalized in this country because of Mandela and so on, one of our ladies, Tanya, she went through the pornography things, identified who all the advertisers were, and one of them was Toyota. So I wrote a letter to Toyota on our letter saying, you know, how much our mission is Toyota's and how we will have to rethink this if they will not rethink the advertising strategy. And I'm sure many others think the same, and they've instantly, we will cancel contracts, no more advertising there. Thank you for bringing this to our attention. And in fact, we bankrupted quite a few of the magazines just by going through the advertisers, which was another strategy. We remember you've got a vote basically with your purchasing money. Every time you buy a cinema ticket, you're voting for that kind of film. So we must boycott the bad and support the good. And same thing with products. Now, if you see that, say, this product that you use advertises in a bad publication, as a consumer, you've got a bit of, bit of leverage. Which is what also struck me after being in prison in Zambia. Do you know the first thing I saw? It may sound silly, but after a day of blindfold, hooded, dehydrated, hadn't had anything to drink in 24 hours, and when I pulled off the hood and blindfold, the first thing I saw was "Made in Great Britain" on my handles. And it was funny. I mean, I was actually laughing at the time, choking and laughing. So shortly after that, I went on a speaking tour to Great Britain, to Germany, went to the Frankfurt International Society of Human Rights international conference in Frankfurt. I went to America, and I put quite a lot of pressure on all these people to put pressure on Zambia and so on for what they're doing. So in England, I got to speak on the BBC World Service. BBC World Service, I already knew. Everyone in Africa listens to it. It was very popular, shortwave and so on. So I get on BBC World Service, and I'm speaking about Isaiah Moyo, because I realize you speak about the thousands. Thousands are a statistic. One person is a tragedy. So I focused on Isaiah Moore, a 26-year-old truck driver with a wife and two children back in Soweto, who was arrested for having lent money to ANC cadres who didn't want to pay him back, so they accused him of being self-conspiracies in the cell being tortured. He had red-hot, pussy sores all over his body with a poker from the fire and pushed it into his body all over. So his sores would burst, and anyway, his knees were calloused from praying on the concrete floor. So I gave Isaiah's testimony. Well, I later heard, after Isaiah got released, Isaiah said that the prison guards came running with a shortwave radio to the cell, opened the cell. Isaiah, the white South African missionary, the one who's here, he's on the radio, he's talking about you. And they brought it in, and Isaiah heard the last minutes of my radio program where I gave his address and all this. Well, mail sacks came, parcels from all over the world, people sending, because I gave his address, what to write. And he got soap and salt, and he was given vitamins and books, and he had so many things. Everyone was his friend. No one mistreated him. He's a celebrity in the prison. And shortly after that, the Zambian government released him. So, I mean, it's just one example of how what we bind will be bound, what we loose will be loosed. And so we've got the power through persuasion and prayer and pressure. Luke 18, the Lord says we should always pray and not give up, because of the unjust judge, although he didn't fear God and he didn't care about men, but because this widow would not halt, she kept praying and pressuring. So governments don't see the light until they felt the heat. Turn up the pressure. Pressure on the governments, prayer to the Lord. And, well, we saw Isaiah released. There was an Australian missionary at that time locked up in Mozambique, so I focused on him too. He got released. There was a South African girl locked up in Chikurubi in Harare. We focused on her. So I focused on individuals. And by the time I got back, everyone of the three had been released, of the ones that we had focused, that we had names of. And we heard that the prison conditions in Lusaka improved dramatically because of that coverage over there. So I went to the people who were supporting this. My Mozambique report was read into the congressional record in the Senate by Senator Jeremiah Denton, who is the top man. We had communication with Jeremiah Denton. In fact, the secretary came out to work for us after a while. But Senator Jesse Helms, North Carolina, he read my Mozambique report in the congressional record, and America cut their aid to Mozambique because of the persecution of Christians. Changed Mozambique's policies around dramatically. Mozambique shortly after that abandoned the war, stopped the persecution of Christians, handed back the churches, allowed missionaries. I mean, there's a lot of things came because of publicity and prayer, and then pressure was brought to bear on the creeps that were funding this. And next thing you knew, the communists said, we prefer foreign aid to foreign prisoners. And so it just shows I don't think governments overseas should be funding these countries anyway. I mean, we all can work for ourselves. There's no need for this. But while they do it, they might as well use that leverage to bring about better conditions for people on ground. Like what we were observing last night, Trump put pressure on Sudan to stop attacking the Nuba, and that provided a 2-year ceasefire in which our team's been able to distribute tens of thousands of Bibles. Schools have been able to be revived. Wells have been dug. All sorts of great things are going on there in this. So it's giving the people breathing space to recover and rebuild their country. So, any other comments? Good. So, here you've got a bit of an overview of some of what can go wrong in a field on a mission. By no means exhaustive. There's a lot more things can go wrong. But what we need to do is have the attitude that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. We're more than conquerors through Christ Jesus who loved us. Greater is he who is in us than he is in the world. Obstacles and challenges in the field are like the obstacle course. At first it looks daunting, but when you've done it a few times, it becomes easy, and then it becomes a challenge. How quickly can we overcome this obstacle course? So we've got to have the mentality that God knows about this. It hasn't taken him by surprise. There's a way around it. It's like a puzzle. There's a solution. And yes, at the time, there were times I was despairing, and there were times I was desperate, and there was times I was depressed, and there was times that I felt so frustrated and I thought there was no hope. There were days when I thought that's my last day on earth. I'm not going to see the sunrise again. And yet, obviously, I survived. I'm here. But the point is that just like our friends, I don't know if you noticed that they turned up in the film box too. Helen Mercer and Donna Curry was also mentioned in the terrorism persecution. These are the two missionaries to Afghanistan who are on death row, killed by the Taliban. Showing that Jesus talked to four Muslims on the laptop. But, you know, Heather Mercer came here, she spoke in this boardroom at our devotions, she's at the dinner table. I read Psalm 27 before supper, and she got so excited, she said, that's a psalm Lord gave us, that's what sustained us in prison. And that was the psalm that sustained me in prison in Zambia, Psalm 27. And so it's extraordinary when you meet people who've experienced prisons and to compare what God used to strengthen you in that time. And it does strengthen you. Hard times can make a stronger faith. Suffering can purge you, purify you, prepare you, make you more prayerful and more powerful. So we shouldn't fear the battles, because you don't get victory without a battle. That's the important thing. Just to understand, you will meet problems in the field. Yours will probably be different from what I had. There's many different challenges God can throw you away. But we can get to the end of it. I'm glad the Lord didn't let me know at the beginning how many things would challenge me over the years. Now, we've overcome them all. But we've had everything from medical, political, financial, you name it. I mean, all sorts of things have happened. And yet, we've survived. Our mission's grown. We've overcome, and with hindsight, we didn't need to be so afraid. And at the time, some of these things seemed so daunting. It's like Pilgrim's Progress.